case of the morning, appeal number 08-1722, Nancy Love versus National City Corporation.
Counsel, my name is Mark Dabowski, and I represent the plaintiff appellant, Nancy Love, in this dispute. Last month, this court issued the case of Tate versus Long-Term Disability Plan, which, in effect, disposes of the main issue in this case. In the Tate case, this court remarked that the plan must have made a reasonable inquiry into Tate's medical condition as well as her vocational skills and qualifications for its decision denying benefits to be upheld. The court goes on to say, but it is the plan's burden to make sure its determination that Tate could perform a job for which she was qualified despite her medical condition is reached in a manner that substantially complies with ERISA. That did not happen here. If you substitute the name Love for the name of Tate in the Tate ruling, you have the blueprint to the outcome in this case. The main defect in the decision that was made by the National City Disability Plan in this case is that it was vocationally deficient. It was also medically deficient, but the primary point of attack is the vocational deficiency in the plan. There is no doubt, despite the comments made in Dr. Sand's report, that Nancy Love suffers from a very serious illness, multiple sclerosis. She has positive MRI findings consistent with multiple sclerosis, both in the brain and in the cervical spine. She has a positive somatosensory evoked potential test of the lower extremities, consistent with multiple sclerosis. She also has a brainstem test, which produced abnormal responses consistent with multiple sclerosis. She's been treated by two neurologists, Dr. Bilkis and Dr. Parikh. The only doctor the plan contacted was Dr. Bilkis. The record shows that no contact was ever made with Dr. Parikh. With respect to the first initial decision that was made in December of 2000, well, let me go back a little bit. As the court is aware, the date of disability in this case was August 7, 2001, and Nancy Love never worked after that date. The plan provided that the initial period of disability under its definition of disability would end on August 6, 2003. At that point, Nancy Love had to prove not only that she was incapable of performing her own very strenuous job as a technical analyst, but that she was unable to perform any job whatsoever. In April of 2003, the plan corresponded with Ms. Love. The plan stated that they were investigating Ms. Love's qualifications under the Any Occupation Standard of Disability. And the letter went on to state that no benefits would be paid beyond August 6, 2003, unless a final decision was made as to her qualification under the Any Occupation Standard. But we know that benefits were paid until December of 2005. And oddly, even though Dr. Sands never gave an opinion, Dr. Sands being the consultant hired by the plan, that Ms. Tate could return to her technical analyst position, the plan determined that she could, misciting Dr. Sands' report. But let's focus on the appeal. After that decision was rendered, the plan had talked in the initial decision about not getting the information that they were looking for from Dr. Bilkis, and again, no effort was made to contact Dr. Parikh, who had performed all of this testing that was done. After the decision was made to terminate the benefits, Ms. Love went the extra mile. This court has recognized in several cases, the Diaz case being one of them, that subjective symptoms can and must be considered by the court if they're consistent with the objective medical evidence. There is no dispute. It is undeniable that MS causes fatigue and pain. But this court also remarked in a decision, Williams versus Aetna, that the plaintiff must show that there are functional restrictions that are consistent with the disability claim. And Ms. Love went that extra mile. She had that testing done, 3 days of testing. 1 day of testing with the physical therapist, who primarily looked at her ocular function and found that she was not tracking words because of a saccades, a nystagmus, which means that her eyes did not focus in the same place at the same time. And then 2 days of functional capacity testing, which determined that she had significant limitations. Now, we're not contending that Ms. Love is bedridden, but that's not the standard in this case. The standard for Ms. Love's disability is whether she could work at her occupation or any other occupation for which she has training, experience, or education. Now, it was found by the Social Security Administration that she lacked transferable skills. That conclusion was also drawn by Christopher Yep, the vocational...
I may interrupt there. Could you clarify for me what happened at the Social Security Administration? Apparently, they did find she could do sedentary work?
No. The administrative law judge concluded that she could perform sedentary work at best. But then the Social Security ALJ went on to talk about the grid regulations under the Social mm-hmm. Security Act, and that the grid regulations really could not be applied. They could only be used in an advisory capacity because Ms. Love suffered from non-exertional impairments, fatigue, and pain. And he concluded, without even the need to hold a hearing, this was an on-the-record decision mm-hmm. based on the medical evidence, the same evidence the plan had, that she could not reliably engage in the performance of any substantial gainful activity whatsoever. Now, it's interesting that the court used the medical vocational rules as a guideline, because one of the cases that we cited to this court was the Second Circuit decision in the Demirovic case versus 32BJ. The Second Circuit prescribed something that we would suggest that this court also consider taking a look at. The court suggested in the Demirovic case that the Social Security medical vocational rules could indeed be a good guideline for disability plans acting under the ERISA law to apply. The court described the rules as well-developed, relatively efficient, and by no means overly generous to claimants. But the plan didn't even look at the medical vocational rules. The plan never retained a vocational specialist. The plan did no vocational evaluation whatsoever.
Did the plan have any burden to come forward with jobs that, in fact, she could do?
Absolutely. That's exactly the conclusion that was reached in the Tate case. The Tate case says explicitly it is the plan's burden to make sure its determination that Tate could perform a job for which she was qualified is reached in a manner that substantially complies with ERISA. I mean, this is a statute that the Supreme Court recently said demands higher than marketplace quality standards on plan administrators. To have done no vocational evaluation whatsoever when Mr. Yep issued a detailed opinion based on all of the medical evidence, based on the functional capacity evaluation, based on the ocular testing, that Ms. Love could not reliably perform any job. For Dr. Winkler, a neurologist, to say she could do this and that, but not specify a particular job, is a violation of the ERISA law. It's an abuse of discretion. That was the same conclusion that this court reached in the Tate case. And for that reason primarily, and for the other reasons stated in our briefs, we ask this court to reverse the decision of the court below and reinstate Nancy Love's benefits. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Okay, Mr. Claiborne.
Good morning. It is plaintiff's burden in this case to demonstrate that the decision terminating the benefits Ms. Love had been receiving was in fact arbitrary and capricious. That is a highly deferential standard of review, unchanged by the Supreme Court's MetLife versus Glenn decision. Ms. Love has not sustained that burden. Allow me to address the Tate case for a moment, because it's apparent from Mr. Dubofsky's argument that he places principal reliance upon that case. The Tate case is remarkably different from this case. An analysis of that case shows, first of all, that the claimant in that case, Tate, had bipolar disorder, causing her volatility, episodic rages, severe mood swings, difficulty in engaging in social interactions, and severely limited interpersonal contacts. Those kinds of things potentially make holding any sort of job impossible. TAPE's records were reviewed by two physicians. The first physician found that perhaps TAPE could perform a less intense job. This court determined that that was not a sufficient analysis of Tate's capabilities because there was no explanation of what that meant. The second plan doctor found that because Tate could maintain her home and did not have suicidal ideation, she could work. As this court pointed out, that had nothing to do with Tate's ability to work. There were no assessment of jobs for which Tate might be qualified given those restrictions. This court did not hold that a vocational assessment is required as a general rule, specifically saying it was not going to address that issue. The situation here is, as I said, remarkably different. Here, Ms. Love's capabilities were assessed. They were assessed by, first of all, a functional capacity evaluation, and secondly, Love obtained a vocational assessment by Mr. Yep. Those findings were presented to the second plan doctor who reviewed Love's qualifications. That physician determined that those...
Who was? Just so I can follow.
Oh,
you.
Dr. Winkler. The first doctor was Dr. Sands. The second was Dr. Winkler. Dr. Winkler had those reports before him. He determined, as a Dr. Sands, that Ms. Love's condition did not preclude her from performing any other occupation. He specifically noted other jobs which she might be capable of. I think to some extent the argument that's been made is a bit of a red herring because there's suggestion here that the plan should have considered whether or not Ms. Love's skills and education precluded her from performing any other sort of job, such as was the case in the Demirovic case, where the claimant was an immigrant with a limited capability of English and limited education and skills.
Counsel, do you have available a citation to Dr. Winkler's report?
Dr. Winkler's report appears at page D15 of the party's joint appendix in support of summary judgment.
Thank you.
Dr. Winkler, viewing the reports that had been presented to him, determined that those reports did not show that Ms. Love was totally disabled, which is the standard that had to be met. That is precisely the kind of judgment that this court's decisions establish should be deferred to in the context of review of an administrator's decision determining the eligibility for ERISA benefits. It is not this court's function, as this court's opinions say, to reweigh the evidence. There is a reasonable basis for that determination. Now, Ms. Love's counsel takes issue with the fact that Dr. Winkler was making a vocational assessment. What Dr. Winkler was doing was making an assessment as to the capabilities of Ms. Love, given what her medical records show. That is the sort of thing that I would submit that doctors do all the time as to whether one is or is not capable of engaging in certain sorts of activities. It is starkly different from the Tate case, where there was no consideration whatsoever of what the claimant's condition in that case may have been and how it may have impacted her job.
Dr. Winkler really doesn't explain his conclusion, though, in light of the evidence that he reviewed. He states it in a conclusory single sentence.
Winkler's opinion is terse and somewhat conclusory. I would not dispute that. However, this court's opinions say that doctors aren't expected to write like lawyers.
That's not engaging the issue here. I'm not suggesting that he has to write like a lawyer. I'm suggesting that he has to explain his conclusion. Even if he writes like a doctor, that's okay. He's got to explain it. And he didn't. He just, a single sentence conclusion, that's it.
Well, I would submit to Your Honor that is an explanation, and it's adequate given the fact that he has reviewed all of Ms. Love's records. He has reviewed Dr. Sands' opinion as well, and has determined that the records that he has reviewed do not support the limitations that were urged.
That inhibits our review. I mean, we have to be reviewing something other than the conclusion, and if the conclusion is not explained, then our review is inhibited.
The conclusion is explained by the entire context of the case. Dr. Winkler specifically referred to these reports as having been submitted on Ms. Love's behalf. He's
right,
recited
but all of the reports that she submitted said she's disabled, and he says in one sentence she's not.
Well, Dr. Winkler does not stand alone. Dr. Sands reached the same conclusion.
In a similar conclusory fashion.
Well, I would submit to Your Honor that Dr. Sands is not as terse.
Yeah,
because he says that the restrictions are not supported by the medical records, in essence. I think that Dr. Winkler builds on Dr. Sands' opinion, says, I've looked at the additional information submitted in support of the appeal, and it's clear to me that Ms. Love is not totally disabled based upon the record.
Does either Dr. Winkler or Dr. Sands ever say that she could be gainfully employed 8 hours a day, 5 days a week?
Dr. Winkler specifically refers to the statements that are made in the functional capacity evaluation that there's a 67 to 100% assessment in that FCE that Ms. Love could be employed on an 8-hour day per day basis. You know, a subject as to which, by the way, as we pointed out in our brief, the other doctors who examined Ms. Love are in disagreement as to what her capacities are. We don't have a uniformity of voice on the other side. Indeed, I would point out with regard to the functional capacity evaluation that the functional capacity evaluation, which took place over 2 days, observes no pain behaviors whatsoever on Ms. Love's part, further lending support to the conclusion that the plan reached, that the medical condition that was reported did not support the limitations that were voiced by her doctors. Now, I would further point out with regard to the vocational assessment argument that's made here. If Dr. Winkler's assessment that Ms. Love could work is somehow or other suspect because he's a medical doctor, so too is the assessment of all the other physicians who examined her and determined that she could not work. I think that dichotomy, if that's the right word for it, demonstrates the fundamental inconsistency in the argument that's being made here with regard to the vocational assessment. With regard to the overall standard of review here, appellee's brief argues that somehow the MetLife case changes that standard. I would submit to you that that's not supported by either the MetLife case itself, intervening decisions of this court, including Tate, which applied the standard in the same fashion that had been applied before, or subsequent decisions of other circuit courts of appeals. Unless the court has further questions, I would simply sum up.
What about this issue of the conflict of interest?
Well, the issue of the conflict of interest, first of all, was waived below because it was not addressed, even though it could have been. There was no mention of the MetLife case or of the subject at all in the opening in the briefs below, and only a one-paragraph terse reference to it in the appellee's brief in opening brief in this court. Putting that aside, as we demonstrated in our brief, the amount of money at issue with respect to Ms. Love, which I think is $104,000 in this case, is de minimis in terms of the overall financial condition of National City Corporation, which is one of the largest bank holding companies in the country. So I think that even if conflict of interest were not waived, it does not weigh in the balance here. The balance of the facts simply show that this was an appropriate decision complying with ERISA and should be affirmed. Thank you.
Anything further?
The Supreme Court did remark in Glenn, in quoting from the Third Circuit opinion in Bruck versus Firestone, every dollar provided in benefits is a dollar spent by the employer, and every dollar saved is a dollar in the employer's pocket. So the financial issue that counsel just raised is no longer a valid issue after the Glenn case. With respect to the point about the summary of the functional capacity evaluation, again, pointing to the Glenn case, this is a focus on one small piece of evidence to the exclusion of the record as a whole. Glenn said that that's improper. The functional capacity evaluation, which was performed over 2 days, concluded that Ms. Love could not work 5 days a week, 8 hours a day. And that's exactly the point that Mr. Yep made in his vocational assessment. He did not paint a totally bleak picture, and neither are we. But Mr. Yep's point is well taken. He says, though she has good times, at which time she can be functional and accomplish different tasks, her overall abilities are unpredictable at best. Given the information provided, this individual would not be able to sustain work activities on a regular or consistent basis and thus is not employable on a competitive full-time basis. Common sense, but supported by the evidence as well and consistent with the evidence of record. Thank you.
Okay, this case will be taken under advisement.